Blog Talk Radio.
Last few days, obviously had issues with the internet at the studio here. Sorted out, but it's sorted out just in time for you to get one more episode before the break. So off Thursday, Friday, and Monday. So it's a nice little shortish vacation. Got some family stuff gonna do, some family Christmas stuff. I got to do annoying shit like renew my driver's license. That's always fun. And that's the deal, man. But I got a jam-packed show for you since there's not going to be a show until Tuesday. So buckle up. All right, I'm going to give you a quick little rundown, and then we'll jump into it. So we have publicintegrity.org has an incredible story about open corruption from the Trump people. Shock, shock. We also have, I'm taking a sip of my drink. We have a new poll out on the Trump era, and it's interesting to see who thinks it's going to be positive, who thinks it's going to be negative, and we're going to dive into, you know, why we think that and why they think that. Obama also just did a couple bold moves out the door, which he deserves credit for, and there's some amazing facts on senior poverty that I have to give you. Plus, a Democratic senator decides that, you know, maybe we need to try this new idea of having a war on drugs. I'm not kidding. It's a real story. Wait until I give you the facts on that one. All right, so let's get started. And we're going to do that with Donald Trump and the new kind of corruption that he's doing. Publicintegrity.org has an incredible story about open corruption by the Trump team. They explain here, a new Texas nonprofit led by Donald Trump's sons is offering access to the freshly minted president during inauguration weekend, all in exchange for million-dollar donations to unnamed conservation charities, according to interviews and documents reviewed by the Center for Public Integrity. And the donors' identities may never be known. Prospective million-dollar donors to the opening day 2017 event receive a private reception and photo opportunity for 16 guests with President Donald J. Trump, a multi-day hunting and or fishing excursion for four guests with Donald Trump Jr. and or Eric Trump and team, as well as tickets to other events and autographed guitars by an opening day 2017 performer. Okay, so this is the clearest example I've ever seen of selling access. They're selling access to President-elect Donald Trump. Now, why would they do that? It's simple. For the exact same reason why we all went after the Clinton Foundation. For corrupt reasons. For pay-to-play reasons. You want to give me $1 million? You want to give me a few $1 million for inauguration? Well, here's the deal. We're going to make sure that we give it to conservation charities, unnamed again, and then you can spend time with President-elect Donald Trump, and you can spend time with the kids, Eric and Fuckface, and don't worry, there's no funny business going on here. So the result of that is when this happens, and then Donald Trump is president of the United States, he's going to get a call from whoever those donors were. When he gets that call, he's going to take that call. When the person on the other end of the line goes, remember that thing that we spoke about when we were out fishing? I think I need you to act on that. And, you know, it might come in the form of some sort of corporate welfare check, subsidy, giant tax break, piece of legislation that allows them to continue doing tax dodging and using doing corporate tax avoidance. It can come in the form of bailout. It can come in the form of any of a number of things, deregulation, where the government ends up doing favors for the people who give money to them. And Donald Trump, one of the things he ran on was, we have to stop that. We got to drain the swamp. I'm against the lobbyists. I still remember clearly during the debates when he was ranting against Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and the other idiots, and he was basically saying, what are you? Are you a puppet? I think these guys are puppets to their donors. It's sad. Sad. And there was one time when they, like, the Republican establishment stacked the audience against Trump, and the people were cheering for Jeb when he went after Trump. And Trump was like, that's all his donors out there. And I was like, damn, he's fucking them up. And he was able to blow up the whole debate and blow up the whole system simply by pointing out the reality that all those people are puppets to corporations and billionaires. Well, now that Donald Trump's in power, he's the exact same thing. I mean, the guy's already appointed or he's picked two different people from Goldman Sachs for his administration. That ain't draining the swamp. That is the swamp. That's a new swamp on the White House lawn. That's draining the swamp in your mouth. So now it's at the point where, I mean, this is Clinton Foundation level shit. Remember, what was the response from partisan Democrats when we said, hey, man, that Clinton Foundation, that is pay-to-play corruption, and that's a problem, and you can't have that. What was the response? The response was, oh, so I guess you're against charity, aren't you? No. Oh, I guess you're saying that the Clinton Foundation has done no good around the world. I guess that's what you're saying. No. The argument is they're taking money from, you know, various corporate leaders, billionaires, foreign governments, and then, sure, you might put that money to some good use. Of course, nobody's arguing against that. Why do you have a foundation? Why do you have a charity? Former president of the United States and somebody who wants to be the next president of the United States. It's because you are getting those connections ready. So you can fundraise, and then when you get in office, you return all the favors for the people who gave you the money. And we've seen it in real time. I mean, for example, the government of Qatar giving Bill Clinton $1 million for his birthday for the Clinton Foundation. And then lo and behold, look at that, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton approved a weapons deal for Qatar. So that was the issue. Now, he's going to do the exact same fucking thing here, Donald Trump, and his dumbass sons. They're going to do the exact same thing. Here's a fishing trip. Here's a hunting trip. Thank you for a couple $1 million. You know you gave this just out of the kindness of your heart, right? I mean, that's the only – there's no foul play going on here. And then, of course, later on you do favors for them. This story highlights the exact problem that's wrong in our politics. There's a reason why Congress has a fucking 9% approval rating, and on a good day it's like 21%. It's because everybody knows they're not representing them. Everybody knows they're representing the donors. And they're all guilty of it, man. They're all guilty of it. I mean, maybe there's a handful of good politicians who somehow have managed to maintain their integrity. But for most of those politicians, they could even be a good person, and they end up acting like this, and they end up acting in a bad way because it's the incentive structure of the system, and it's human nature. So you really need to be a special, special person to override it, somebody like Bernie Sanders, for example. But this is – and to be fair and be nonpartisan here, Ron Paul was able to override it too. He had an actual philosophy, and he stuck by that philosophy, whether or not I agree with it. So what we see here is the cancer, the virus within our system. And Trump is not the solution to it. Trump is just another example of it. And if anything, he might be putting it into hyperdrive. I mean, his rhetoric on the campaign trail, I think in his mind, he thinks that gives me cover to do whatever I want. I was so anti-establishment on the campaign trail in my rhetoric, and now I can act like the most establishment president ever, and it doesn't matter, because my followers are only going to listen to the rhetoric. They're going to defend me no matter what. So that's why you get multiple Goldman Sachs picks. That's why you get the CEO of ExxonMobil he picks for Secretary of State. He picks neocon John Bolton for Deputy Secretary of State, the number two at the State Department, and that guy's a neocon who's for every war, when Trump at times on the campaign trail said he was against war. You get a fast food CEO for labor secretary. The guy he picked for labor secretary is anti-labor. I'm not kidding. He said, I want to, use automation as opposed to the workers. Let's go in the direction of automation. What? He's against the minimum wage. I mean, the list goes on and on. This guy's Ayn Rand's wet dream. In fact, he wrote a book where he basically outlines his philosophy and what it is on economics, and it's basically right in line with Ayn Rand. So this is, it's really bad. And everybody needs to keep in mind, yet again, he's not draining the swamp. He's building a brand new swamp. And I don't even think his ardent followers are going to look at it and go, yeah, that's bad. Let's turn against him. I think they'll do exactly what they did under Reagan and do exactly what they did under George W. Bush and just play defense. And that's a horrific direction for the country. Okay. Now, I am going to move along here and let's talk a little bit about this interesting article about what Trump actually can do for workers. Daniel Marins has an interesting article where he explains what Donald Trump can easily do if he really wants to fight for workers and if he really wants to fight outsourcing. So listen to this. He says, federal procurement is one way Trump could boost domestic manufacturing with relative ease. Congress requires the federal government to favor American-made products when it buys things. But in recent decades, the U.S. has exempted goods produced in countries with which the U.S. has trade agreements from so-called Buy America provisions. As a result, rather than using its purchasing power to give preferential treatment to goods produced domestically, the federal government treats goods manufactured in countries like Mexico and China the same as if they were American-made products. Because those elements of trade agreements are enacted through regulatory waivers, Trump can simply scrap the waivers. Okay, so first of all, why the fuck isn't Obama fixing this? So that's, I'm talking to you now, President Obama. I didn't even know that it was this easy to immediately reduce outsourcing and immediately make it so that you have more jobs in the U.S. and you actually favor American products over products made in Mexico and China. I didn't know that. Now I know that. So now I'm like, Obama, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? Because at times, Obama has shown, well, look, I'm not nearly as big of a dick to the workers as the Republicans are. Like, for example, the thing we always bring up, which is changing the overtime rules. He made it so that instead of making $23,000 and less makes you eligible for overtime by law, it was $47,000 and less. That's a lot of workers he gave a raise to. So obviously he's not, you know, as big of a dick as Mitch McConnell is to the workers. That's obvious. But this shows you his neoliberal roots and how he is an establishment Democrat. Because this is the easiest thing in the world. Oh, I am now scrapping the regulations that allow Mexican products and Chinese products to be considered American products when, you know, the federal government buys goods. Fuck that. No, I'll buy all American. If it's the fucking federal government, of course you should be buying American. Of course you should be. Like, no, Chinese is close enough. What? What does that even mean? Well, we're allies. So, and even that argument at this point is like, we're not even really necessarily allies on good terms now, are we? But even if we were allies, what? Like, what's the counter-argument? Oh, my God, it's a sign of bigotry if you say you prefer American-made products to Chinese products. This is what I call McLiberalism. It ain't real liberalism. It's McLiberalism. So Obama should do this, and it's pathetic that he hasn't done it. But, okay, so now the challenges laid out there for Donald Trump. You say you want to help workers. Now, you did the carrier deal. I was one of very few people on the left who gave you at least some credit for it because you said, hey, I'm going to keep the carrier jobs here, and you kept some of the carrier jobs here. Now, he lied the entire way through. He said it was over 1,000 jobs, then finally we learned it was only 730 jobs, and most of the jobs are still going to Mexico. But he followed through. He did it the wrong way with, hey, I'm going to give you deregulation. I'm going to give you $7 million of basically a corporate welfare check. So he's wrong in the way he did it, but he did it. So it's a little more of a mixed picture than just, oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. I'd say it's mostly terrible, but at least he followed through on that, the promise. But was that just symbolic for you to, you know, strut around and go, yeah, I care about the workers, now watch as for the next 4 years or maybe 8 years I do nothing to help the workers? Or do you really give a shit about the work? So if you do, super easy, do it. And by the way, if you were to do this, I would come out here, give him total credit. Look, again, when we got the initial news of the carrier deal, that's what I did. Later on, when we found the specifics of it, then I got to tell you, oh, he went about it the wrong way, and now other companies are going to basically threaten the U.S. and say, I'll leave unless you give me corporate welfare too. So, but I initially gave him credit. Same thing for this. If he comes out and there's no funny business attached to it, I'll come out and say, oh, look, he did the right thing. This is something Obama could have done, Obama didn't do, but now Trump did it. Buy American simply for when the federal government buys shit. Easiest fix ever. Doesn't need to go through Congress. You could do it with the, you know, a single signature probably. That's it, man. That's it. So, and when I read stuff like this, do you have any idea how badly I wish I was president? Because it's like, duh. This is such an easy thing to do, and you help so many people in the country. You have no idea how quickly I would sign this. In fact, you know how people say, my first day as president, I'm going to do this. Well, 90% of those things you don't have time to get to, and they're more complicated than just saying it and all that stuff. But this is one of those things where, you know, I would literally do this on day one. I'd be like, okay, here, boom. We're buying American for when the federal government buys stuff. And I'm sure everybody listening right now would do that too, because you're not bought pricks. Apparently that's what's going on in our government, and that's why they haven't gotten rid of this obviously ridiculous loophole in the rules that says Chinese goods are American goods. Yeah, that's it. All right, more. Let's go. All right, wait until you hear this new poll on the Trump era. We have a new poll on the Donald Trump era in politics, and I think there are some really interesting findings in this. So they say 79% of Republicans think Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party. Of those that say he's changed the GOP, 83% perceive the change as positive, according to a new Pew Research report. By contrast, among the 67% of Democrats who think Trump's changed the GOP, 72% see the change as negative. So, I mean, I guess, you know, some might say, hey, this really isn't all that interesting because all that's showing is that people are partisan. And the Republicans are like, oh, he's made our party so much better because he's our guy. And the Democrats are like, oh, he's made it so much worse because he's your guy. He's not our guy. But no, here's why I think this is interesting. The question of who's right. The answer is maybe a little unexpected, but both. So you might think, well, how's that possible? Aren't those contradictory things? No. So let me explain. For the conservatives, for the Republicans who say, oh, he's made the party better. If they're referring to some very specific areas, I agree he's made the party better. So he took the Republican Party from everybody who's a Republican politician, everybody in the Republican establishment would go out there and say, yeah, we're going to outsource jobs. That's kind of what we do. We're Republicans. Yeah, we're in favor of free trade deals. Yeah, we still defend NAFTA. Yeah, we want to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah, we want to reform them or privatize them. Yeah, we don't want to do infrastructure. He took a party that said that on everything. Yeah, we want more war. Of course we want more war. We're Republicans. He took that party and went, no. And he argued, we're going to do infrastructure spending. We're going to stop doing all the wars. Now, the other half of the time, he was even more hawkish than, you know, any other Republican on stage, where we got to take out their families. But half of his rhetoric was, let's not do all the wars. I'm not going to cut Medicare and Social Security. I'm just not going to do it. I hate NAFTA. I'm not going to do TPP. Why would I do TPP? Why would I screw over the workers? So if you isolate certain comments he's made on economics, he's by far and away better than Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and all the other idiots on stage who just had totally gulped the Rush Limbaugh Kool-Aid, the Ronald Reagan Kool-Aid, where they lost touch so much that they really believed that that's something that, like, the people want to hear. Like, oh, people want to hear that you're going to cut their Social Security. No, they don't. Nobody wants to hear that. Look at the fucking polls. So in that sense, he has made the party better, because now he's now laid out the model so that any other Republican that comes out there, they know, I at least have to pay lip service to those things, those liberal ideas. Now, again, it would just be a mask, because the Republicans, even Trump himself, likely really is going to try to reform and privatize, you know, Medicare and Social Security. I mean, he's already appointing people to go down that road. He probably is going to, at the end of the day, do some sort of an outsourcing deal. I don't know exactly the makeup of it, but the guy himself has outsourced his own jobs. So this idea that he's, like, really principled on it, no, it was campaign rhetoric. But in terms of the direction of the party and the rhetoric that drives the party, yeah, he's made it better in that specific sense. Now, where the Democrats right that Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party for the worse? Well, that answer is much simpler. When you look at all of his comments on social issues. So when he, for example, says we're going to kick out or we're going to ban 1.6 billion Muslims from coming into the country, we're going to deport all undocumented immigrants, we're going to do nationwide stop and frisk, which disproportionately targets minority communities, well over 90% of the time, they get nothing out of these stops, so all you're doing is taking away the Fourth Amendment rights of innocent people. When he says we're going to torture, quote, even if it doesn't work. When he says we have to take out their families, talking about terrorist families, not the terrorists, the families of the terrorists, we have to take out their families. So you're advocating massacring civilians. When you say stuff like that, what he's doing is he's wearing empire on his sleeve. He's wearing imperialism on his sleeve. When you pick the CEO of ExxonMobil for Secretary of State, you're just getting rid of the middleman. Remember, how many times did Trump say during the election, we're going to take the oil, we're going to take the oil, I would have taken the oil, we're going to take the oil, we're going to take the oil. Well, now he's put some money in a place where, yeah, no, that's exactly what they're going to do, that's exactly what they want to do. Oh, we've already taken plenty of that oil, or we've increased the output of oil from the Middle East in certain areas that we've taken over. Shock, shock. But I don't doubt that he's going to do it more. He's going to jack more natural resources, and yeah, now he's appointing John Bolton as number two at the State Department. He's probably going to be massively neocon. But what he's done is he's ripped away even the veneer of civilization and human rights that we had. Now, look, there's an argument of, oh, well, then he's just being more honest about what we're already doing. Maybe. But the answer is to go in the opposite direction, not to continue and double down on the bad direction. And also, remember, I think there's something categorically different about Donald Trump saying, yeah, we have to take out their families, that's the point, versus Hillary Clinton, where there's no doubt there's blood on her hands for her vote for the Iraq War and how hawkish she's been and continues to be. But if you go into the Oval Office and there's a President Hillary Clinton sitting there and you tell her, Madam President, we just accidentally droned a wedding in Yemen, she would say, oof. Come on, guys, we got to be better. If you tell Trump, he goes, end? That's the point. So I think there's a difference there that we shouldn't gloss over. They're both monsters, but the intent of one is more monstrous. It's the difference between manslaughter and murder. They're both crimes, and we should argue against both of them until we're blue in the face, no doubt. But let's not pretend that it's 50-50, because it's not. So he's basically made it so that the ugliest parts of America. I mean, we already have Geneva Conventions. Doesn't apply to us. Nuremberg Tribunal, international law, piss off. Trump actually said, yeah, no, I want to, the Geneva Conventions is, quote, the problem. I want to be out of that thing. So even the veneer of civilization is gone, and the precedent that sets is scary. Because when the world's sole superpower is shouting from the rooftops, we don't care about law! I mean, like when Dick Cheney and George Bush tortured, they said, it's not torture, it's enhanced interrogation. Total bullshit. But they had plausible deniability. So if any other country starts to do horrific things, they go, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're violating the law. You can't do that. With Trump, like, no, we're going, yes, we're doing that. We're torturing. We love it. We love it. Well, then you send a sign, a signal to every other country on earth, enemy or not, it's open season, man. There are no more rules. Fuck Magna Carta. Fuck human rights. Fuck altruism. Fuck all that. We're in the Wild West, son. Survival of the fittest. And that's a very, very, very damaging thing. So he's now made it virtuous in the eyes of some to be a monster. It used to be with Cheney and Bush, they're doing all these gross things, and they knew it was gross, so they had to, like, keep it on the hush-hush, bitch. But with Trump, he just wears it on his sleeve, and now his followers are like, yeah! So now, it's the morality chickens coming home to roost for how the U.S. has been acting post-World War II, with our sole superpower garbage and all of our needless interventions that fucked everything up further and killed massive numbers of innocent civilians. Now they're just like, yeah, we're going to stop pretending. It's not about being the world police. It's not about human rights. We're allies with some of the most monstrous regimes. Sometimes we act in the most monstrous ways. So it is what it is, man. It is what it is, and get over it. You don't like it? Blow me. There's nothing good about that. There's nothing good about that. We should actually give a shit about human rights. We should actually give a shit about civil liberties. We should actually try to do the right thing and try not to hurt people. But he's like, that's all irrelevant to me, man. That's irrelevant. And he is a thin-skinned, narcissistic, greedy buffoon. And I think that that has terrible consequences for what he'll do and also the precedent he'll set. So this is it's bad. So I would say, yes, on the economic front, in some limited ways, he's better, at least in his rhetoric, and he's shown that populism is the way to go. But when it comes to many other areas, when it comes to the issue of torture, when it comes to the issue of civil liberties, when it comes to the issue of war and intent in harming civilians, stuff like that, regulation too, when he says, yeah, I want to get rid of the EPA and the FDA. And then he appoints people who are going to oversee them that don't believe in them. Well, that's also really, really, really bad, and that's a case that he's making the party worse. So there you have it. It's a mixed picture, but overall, definitely a net negative. All right, let me take a break. When we come back, Obama did a bold move on his way out the door. He did a few bold moves. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about the insane, I mean, the level to which student loan debt is fucking everything up for people is absolutely ridiculous. All right, so stay right there, guys. We'll be right back with that and much more.
It's the one and only Nico Double G. You know I'm hopping with the D-R-E. Back up. And when they bang this in the club, baby, you got to get up. Thug homies, yeah, they giving it up. Low life, yo life, boy, we living it up. Taking chances while we dancing in the party for show. Slip my girl up when she crept in the back door. Chickens looking at me strange, but you know I don't care. Step up in this mother, just a swing in my hair. Trick, quit talking, quick walk if you down with the set. Take a put some grip and take this on the jam. Out of town, put it down for the father of rap. And if you happen to get cracked, trick, shut your trap. Come back, get back, that's the part of success. If you believe in the S, you'll be relieving your stress.
It's the one and only D-R-E. Ride to him in your fleet. Keep the bill rolling on the something to post on. Locust Stone for the 2000. Coming real, it's the next episode. Hold up.
Censored is a bizarre experience, isn't it? They don't need, because they don't even hit you with the line at the end. It's like, makes the fucking song. Smoke weed every day. Like, you can't, how do you have that song without that? That's so important. Alright, still got a lot to get to, so let's dive right in here. I got a bunch of segments on President Obama and some good stuff he's done. Why the fuck is my computer making noises? Okay. All right, here we go. President Obama just did a pretty bold move on his way out of the White House. He banned offshore oil drilling. So Huffington Post explains the particulars of the deal. President Obama will use his executive authority to permanently block offshore drilling in large swaths of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans, the White House announced Tuesday. The withdrawal includes 115 million acres in the Arctic and 3.8 million acres in the North and Mid-Atlantic Ocean, according to the Interior Department. The permanent protections, which are separate from the temporary bans announced as part of the Obama administration's five-year oil and gas lease program, rely on a provision of the 1953 Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. All right, so let me pause and explain something real quick. When I first read the headline, I thought, yeah, okay, Obama, well done. You're waiting until now to ban it. But President Trump is going to come right in and go, that's nice, I disagree. I'm reversing that. So you ban it for like 13 and a half minutes and get all the pats on the back, and then he changes it. That was my first reaction. It turns out I was wrong about that. That was a cynical reaction. But when you get the details of the deal, here's what they say. So they're not just doing it through executive action. They're doing it through a provision of the 1953 Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. Quote, the provision gives presidents the power to, from time to time, withdraw from disposition any of the unleased lands of the Outer Continental Shelf. Of course, it is likely that Trump, who has called climate change bullshit and a hoax, will attempt to rescind such a ban. But as the White House official told reporters, there is no provision in the law providing for such a reversal. So understand what that means. Obama's doing a power play here. He's going, oh, that's cute. I'm going to ban offshore oil drilling in the Arctic and, you know, and in the North and Mid-Atlantic Ocean. And if you disagree, sucks for you, you can't change it. Now, if Trump tries to change it, the response is going to be, well, no, it wasn't just an executive order, an executive action. It was through a provision of the 1953 Continental Shelf Lands Act, which allows me to do that, but it doesn't allow you to reverse it. So if you want to reverse it, you got to go back through Congress, bitch. Good luck with that. Now, knowing Trump, he might say, I don't care, I'm going to reverse it. Well, then you can bring a lawsuit against him. So, kind of a strong move from Obama. Now, look, you just have to hope that the reasoning and the logic that the administration is giving is not a bluff, and they're right in accordance with the law. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a lawyer in this particular field that they're working in. So there's a chance that if somebody is highly educated on this, and they are a lawyer with this kind of stuff, they can go, yeah, that's not true. Trump could go in there and reverse it like that. But either way, it's a strong move either way, because it's an attempt to, at the very least, bluff and make him go, oh, I guess I can't change that. But there's a chance it even is the case that he lays this all out and Trump can't reverse it unless, you know, he goes through Congress or he tries to reverse it and then there'll be a lawsuit against him. So it is a strong move from Obama, and my original skepticism is not totally merited. My original skepticism was, yeah, okay, dipshit, you're just going to do it now and he's going to come in and right away and just change it. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, and or at least they're portraying it as that, so it might be a somewhat smart move politically, and it might be a strong move, and it's so rare to see strength from Obama. I mean, Obama is weakness defined when it comes to liberal politics. His whole thing was, I'm going to start the negotiation with a not-that-liberal position, and then I'm going to cave even further to just a conservative position. That's how we got Obamacare, Obamacare being a right-wing reform with the individual mandate system. I mean, the actual liberal position is single-payer, and then the watered-down liberal position is public option. He caved on both of those. But this goes across the board. I mean, the stimulus package was like, what, a third tax cuts or something? So this is not Obama's MO, but it's nice to see him doing something like this. And it's nice to see that in his final term, in some ways, he's been much more liberal, much more progressive than he was in his first term. Okay. Now let me give you some more, bitch. All right, more positive stuff from Obama. Shocker. Obama is doing some more positive stuff in his final days in office. Listen to what he did for atheists. So Pathios explains here, for the first time, atheists and other non-religious persons are explicitly named as a class protected by the law. President Obama has signed into law the Frank Wolf International Religious Freedom Act. The new law protects atheists, humanists, and other free thinkers around the world from religious persecution. The new law explicitly protects atheists, humanists, and non-theists, and upgrades the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act. In particular, the new law states the following. The freedom of thought, conscience, and religion is understood to protect theistic and non-theistic beliefs, as well as the right not to profess or practice any religion. The act also condemns specific targeting of non-theists, humanists, and atheists because of their beliefs, and attempts to forcibly compel, quote, non-believers or non-theists to recant their beliefs or to convert. So, overall, a law like this, it is symbolic because we don't have, I mean, the United States is the United States. We have jurisdiction over the United States. We don't have jurisdiction over the world, nor should we. But it's still a good thing, and it's still a step in the right direction because it's finally openly acknowledging non-believers and treating them as somewhat human, at least in discourse. Obama was apparently the first president to bring up non-religious people. I'm not sure if it was at a State of the Union address or a different speech he gave, but he was the first one to be like, yes, let's fight for the rights of, you know, and protect the rights of minorities and various religious communities and non-believers. So that's a first. So again, that's a giant step in the right direction. But I feel like what's often missed in this conversation is the exact reason why something like this is needed. Because some people might scoff and go, yeah, who cares? Like, what do you mean? They're atheists. Like, oh, atheists aren't, you know, going through anything. Well, that's not true. So, for example, when you look at the polls, atheists are more disliked than Muslims, gays, and blacks. Now, I don't know if you know this. Those groups, particularly in, the West, they haven't had it that great. Muslims are less than 1% of the population in the U.S. There's been a spike in anti-Muslim hate crimes recently. Everybody knows the shitty deal blacks have gotten and gays until recently. They didn't have the right to marry. And they still, by the way, they're not a protected class in the sense that, like, you can still get fired simply for being gay or kicked out of a place of business simply for being gay in over 20 states. So they kind of have it rough, but atheists, according to polling, are more disliked than them. About half of the American people say, I wouldn't want my kid to marry an atheist. Imagine that in any other context. Imagine somebody said, you know, if there was a poll, about half of the American people don't want their kid to marry a Jew. They don't want their kid to marry a black. And all of us cringe because we go, that's kind of the textbook definition of bigotry. But when it comes to atheists, people don't frame it in that way and they don't think of it that way, but they should. Also, 50% of Americans say they wouldn't vote for an atheist. Now, that one, I think, is a little more of a complicated picture because they say they wouldn't until they would. It was kind of like with Obama, like, oh, America will never have a black president. And then people were like, well, we like that guy. So I feel like the same thing could happen with atheists, but it is striking that, you know, it's just an open, like, people are like, yeah, no, of course. Well, I wouldn't vote for an atheist. And here's the reasoning behind that. Many people equate atheism with immorality. So when somebody tells you, hey, I'm an atheist, they hear, I don't believe in right and wrong, I don't believe in treating people good, you know, fuck the message of Jesus, which is hilarious because if you look at polling on atheists versus Christians, so the atheist community versus the Christian community, the beliefs of the atheist community are much more in line with the philosophy, the hippie aspect philosophy of Jesus. So atheists act a lot more like Jesus than Christians do. And yet we're the ones that get judged as, oh, I mean, atheist, you're immoral. That's what you are. That's for you to say I'm an atheist, you're admitting I'm immoral. There's also 7 states in the U.S. that bar atheists from running for office. Now, understand that one's, again, more complicated because at a federal level, that's illegal. You can't have a religious test for office. So technically, even though on the state law books, it says they're banned from running in certain places, that wouldn't hold up in court, so you can run as an atheist anywhere in the U.S. But it does show you something that's just that language is on the books, and nobody's like, hey, we got to change that now, that's crazy. Because if there was language still on the books of, like, Jews can't run for office here. Damn Jews, damn Muslims, they can't run for office here. People would be like, oh, that is gross. But, again, with atheists, nobody thinks about it. It's on the books, and nobody talks about it, nobody thinks about it, but that's a clear sign of anti-atheist bigotry. That's exactly what that is. Polls also show that atheists are as distrusted as rapists. And also, get this, this is the amazing thing, and this is why this piece of legislation is important. 19 countries punish apostasy. 14 countries kill you for being an atheist. So that is grotesque. And to have the U.S. government say, wink and a nod, you know, we recognize atheists and we're on your side. Again, there's no teeth to this bill because it's international and we obviously don't have jurisdiction over everybody, but it's a sign of progress and moving in the right direction. What actually needs to happen, though, in terms of legislation? Well, obviously you get rid of those laws on the 7 state books immediately. Obviously, but also I would argue you need to add atheists to the actual list of protected classes. So in other words, you could still technically be fired if you're an atheist, and if you're in the Bible Belt, some employer might find it out and say, we don't like your kind and fire you. So you have to add them to the list of protected classes where you can't simply be fired or mistreated for being X, for being an atheist. So right now it's like you can't just be fired solely on the basis, you're abroad, you're a woman, fired. oh, you're a Jew, fired. You know, you're a black. Ah, you're a minority. I don't like your kind. Fired. You can't do that. That's against the law. There are protections for those classes. Specifically, historically, they face more discrimination. So you can't just say, solely based on that, I'm going to fire you. I think atheists should be added to the list of protected classes. So it's a step in the right direction. I'd like to see them go a little bit further. But it's good to see the tides turning and people's minds beginning to change on this issue. Okay. All right, now let's talk a little bit about, I feel like this story is, one of the saddest of the day. But it needs to be discussed, so that's why we're here. Zach Carter is reporting on some amazing facts here regarding senior poverty that I was totally unaware of and totally clueless on. So he says, student debt is forcing tens of thousands of elderly Americans into poverty, according to a new Government Accountability Office report. More than 110,000 senior citizens had their Social Security checks garnished in 2015 to pay off student loans they'd already defaulted on. Nearly 70,000 Americans over the age of 50 are living in poverty as their Social Security benefits are cut to pay off student loan debts. It's possible to trace the student debt debacle among the elderly back to the era of bipartisan cooperation between President Bill Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Prior to 1996, it was illegal for student loan creditors to garnish Social Security checks. Clinton and Gingrich changed that. So that's neoliberalism run amok. You know how people say we need more bipartisanship in Washington? No, we don't. We need less bipartisanship. Because whenever the Republicans and the Democrats agree on something, they're agreeing to screw you. They're never agreeing like, all right, so we're in agreement, right? Single-payer health care. No, it's, oh, we're in agreement, right? Let's give more money to Wall Street and fuck over poor people. That's where there's agreement. Rarely you get a situation like back in the day, Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders would work together and you'd go, oh, you guys are awesome. But most of the time it's, hey, let's work together and fuck over regular people. Am I right? So this Bill Clinton, you know, oh, what a liberal you are, man. Worked with Newt Gingrich. Hey, let's jack money from Social Security checks. Let's do that. No, no, don't do that. So they opened up the door, and this is where we're at now. I mean, think about that, man. 110,000 senior citizens had their Social Security checks garnished in 2015 to pay off student loans that they'd already defaulted on. 70,000 of them living in poverty. So they wouldn't have been in poverty, but then they were living in poverty as a result of their checks being garnished in order to pay for student loans, and they're senior citizens. Did you know that student loan debt is a special kind of debt? You can't file for bankruptcy on student loan debt. So it is extra punitive. Look, this is where people say, oh, you're radical. But it's not radical. There shouldn't even be a thing called student loans. It should be, that's an area where it is completely funded by the government. You know, in many other modern countries, the furthest they go is, all right, you have to pay an entrance fee. So you pay a little entrance fee, whatever the fuck it is, $1,000 or whatever. And then that's it. You're in the university. That's it. You go to college and is what it is and you're done. People don't get, like, you don't get it. In the United States of America, we get fucked. We're getting screwed. The people are getting screwed. I mean, what? We spent $16 trillion on a bailout for Wall Street when it was their decisions and their greed that crashed the world economy. But they get bailed out, $16 trillion, $7 trillion for the Iraq war, $4 billion a year to ExxonMobil for a subsidy. And they say, oh, it's cool, it's for research and development. They're one of the most profitable corporations in the world. They can't fund their own research and development? No, it's because of corruption. It's because they bought the government, so they get what they want. So what does that mean? It means the government does not prioritize your tax money for you and your kids. They prioritize it for ExxonMobil. They prioritize it for big banks. They prioritize it for Wall Street. They prioritize it for the military-industrial complex. And you keep getting screwed. So your tax money is not reallocated into shit that makes perfect sense for you. It's not reallocated so that when you go to the doctor, you don't need to pay bills. When you go to the emergency room, you don't need to pay bills. That's taken care of. It's not reallocated so you're driving on the nicest roads in the world or you have beautiful airports. It's not reallocated so that our senior citizens aren't still paying off student loan debt. But it should be. And it's not radical for me to say this. What's radical is the system we have right now. This is radical. We covered the list the other day of the countries that have higher education funded by the government. Brazil and Slovenia are on the list. And you don't think we could do it here? We put a motherfucker on the moon. We can't make sure that kids get a college education if they so desire? It's not a radical position to say, let's treat college like we treat high school, like we treat, you know, elementary school and middle school. Yeah, you go to, and a college degree today in the workplace gets you about as far as what a high school degree used to get you. So we're just keeping up by doing that. So this is fucking gross, man. This is gross. We're going to lecture the world about morality and human decency and human rights, and this is what's going on at home? We got all this money to waste overseas. $38 billion we just gave to Israel. By the way, Israel has universal health care already. We don't. But we gave them $38 billion. And then you read this story. Yeah, we got to jack the checks, Social Security checks from old people because they didn't pay off their student loans. These people are victims. Like, you're going to have people, idiots on the right will try to spin it. Like, yeah, I should have been more responsible. Talk about victim blaming. Here's victim blaming. Poor senior citizens who are literally in poverty. And they're like, oh, let's jack some money because of student loans. So some basic shit that should be part of a civilized society that comes out of your tax dollars, no. They'll jack your tax dollars and use it to kill innocent people overseas. And then they take your money, which you need because you want it to go to school. Oh, how you're such a bad person for wanting to go to school. Yeah, how dare you want to make your life better and improve it for the next generation and, you know, have a shot in life. I mean, don't you know that your tax dollars are supposed to go to killing innocent people and not towards educating people and making their lives better and giving them an opportunity? I can't believe it. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren had spoken about this a few years ago. She basically said, do you know we have Congress people who are still paying off student loans? I mean, when I heard that, my mind was blown. I was like, what? That's crazy. But it's worse than that. It's senior citizens, too. In poverty, senior citizens. This is like fucking indentured servitude. This is like, I'm going to make you a deal you can't refuse. I'll let you go to school, and then for the rest of your life, even when you're a senior citizen, I'll be stealing money from you. I mean, that's what this is. Okay, more. Let's go to Bill O'Reilly. Methinks you guys are going to like this one. Bill O'Reilly went on a rant about the Electoral College, and this is absolute gold. Let's watch, and then I'm going to mock it mercilessly.
Abolishing the Electoral College, that is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. After Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, the left in America is demanding that the Electoral College system put into place in 1787 be scrapped. But there's a hidden reason to this. As we reported, even though Secretary Clinton won the popular vote by 2.8 million, the progressive state of California provided all of that margin. Clinton defeating Trump there by about 4.3 million votes. So if the Electoral College were abolished, presidential candidates could simply campaign in the nation's largest states and cities, New York, L.A., Chicago, Houston, and rack up enough votes to pretty much win any election. That's what the left wants. That's what they want. Because in the large urban areas and blue states like New York and California, minorities are substantial. Look at the landscape. Philadelphia, Dallas, Fort Worth, Miami. In all of these places, the minority vote usually goes heavily to the Democrats. Head to that New York City, LA, and Chicago, San Francisco. Don't really have a national election anymore, do you? You have targeted populations. Newspapers like the New York Times and the LA Times have editorialized to get rid of the Electoral College. They well know that neutralizing the largely white rural areas in the Midwest and South will assure liberal politicians get power and keep it. Talking Points believes this is all about race. The left sees white privilege in America as an oppressive force that must be done away with. Therefore, white working class voters must be marginalized. And what better way to do that than center the voting power in the cities?
Counterpoint, it's not all about race. It's about the person who gets the most votes should win. Oh, that is so, yeah, so radical. Kyle, you're so racist for saying that. No, what's hilarious about this is, what does Bill O'Reilly, what do many people on the right say all the time?
No, the left-wingers, they always make it about race when it's not about race. That's what they want to do. They want to make it about race. No, it's not about race, and they want to make it about race.
Exactly what Bill O'Reilly is doing right there. So that's projection 101.
Oh, these liberals, race, it's all about race. It's a hidden reason. It's about race, it's about race.
Okay, look, I get it. Hillary supporters are butthurt, so, and they wanted her to win, so that's why they want to scrap the Electoral College. But every conversation I've had, and every conversation many leftists have had before Hillary Clinton lost, we said, no, I think the Electoral College should go away because I think the person who gets the most votes should win. Nobody ever said, you know, what I really want to do is screw over white people. On the contrary, we think our policies are better for everybody in the country. It's not like, mwahaha, we want to help the blacks and the minorities, and I want to hurt white people. Mwahaha. No, I think liberal policies, I think the politicians that I favor would be better for everybody in the goddamn country. But, and notice, he's spinning it as victimhood for white people, for white males, for the angry white voter. But hold on now. So your argument is, we got to keep it this way. If we don't have one person, one vote. We don't have equality under the law. We have a system that's biased in favor of those people. But he says to argue against that is oppression. Why is it oppression to argue against the system that unfairly favors that demographic group when all we're saying is, let's make it equal. Let's make it even. Let's make one man, one vote the way it goes. So in other words, to take away those voters from having more power, he says, that's oppression, that's victimhood, you're victimizing us. So you're victimizing white rural voters by saying one man, one vote is the way to go. No, what that means is you can't win in the marketplace of ideas. Your ideas aren't strong enough to win and get enough popular votes in the country. So, see, Bill, what they would call that in any other actual democracy is losing. You lost. Your ideas aren't good enough. So, I mean, think about that. He's angry that the liberal position is, hey, maybe people should campaign more where there are more people. He's portraying that as, like, an absurd notion. Like, oh, yeah, what are you going to do? You're going to go to New York City where there's, like, a lot of fucking people? Are you going to go to L.A. where there's, like, a really, really a lot of people? Is that what you're going to do? Yeah. There's a lot of people there. What do you want? He's like, yeah, I think that you should go to fucking Iowa because Iowa's a swing state and there's 37 people there, but you should spend all your time in Iowa and ignore New York and L.A. That's his argument. So he's the one making the argument of, let's unfairly bias it in this direction. As he's claiming the liberals are making that argument. He's saying, let's unfairly bias it towards rural places. As he claims the liberals want to unfairly bias it towards places where there are more people. Bill, that's not a bias. If you say, in an election, I want to go where there are the most people,
to reach the most people and get the most votes and get the most people on my side. That would be called common sense. Why would somebody spend equal time in fucking Montana with -3 people compared to a state where there are millions upon millions and millions of people? It wouldn't make sense. So he wants to unfairly bias it in favor of angry rural white voters when the only point I'm making, I'm not saying give special treatment to black people or minorities or women or anything. I'm saying treat them all equally. Treat them all equally, and the person who gets the most votes should win. And this is coming from somebody who everybody knows who listens to this goddamn show. I despise Hillary Clinton. Would I have been doing cartwheels if Hillary Clinton won? I would have went, no. It is what it is. So I don't like Hillary Clinton. This isn't about Hillary Clinton to me. It's about common sense. It's about setting up a system that is actually more democratic. Since the year 2000 in the U.S., 40% of the elections have gone the opposite of the will of the people. Bill, that's a problem. And believe me, he would agree with us if there's one election where the reverse happened, where the Republican won the popular vote and the Democrat lost the popular vote, but the Democrat won the Electoral College. He would change on a dime. What do you mean? That person got more votes. Their ideas are more popular. Where's the debate? That's right. That argument would be correct. So stop. Again, the hypocrisy in this is so gross. As he's accusing Democrats of wanting to get rid of the Electoral College because of race, because like, oh, the Democrats are race baiters. No, you're race baiting. You're doing it right now. You're doing it right now. You're saying the minority vote should fucking be worth less than the white votes. I want to bias the system in favor of rural white people. You're arguing for that openly, and you're saying that's the point of the Electoral College, and it should be that way. No, it should be one person, one vote. It should be equality under the law, and the person who gets the most votes should win. And the worst-case scenario of the people fighting for that idea right now are simply fighting for it because they're butthurt that Hillary lost. So even among the worst of the people who are arguing to get rid of the Electoral College right now, it's just for sheer partisan reasons, not for racist reasons, not for race reasons. So, but guess what? Many people on the left, including myself, we believe this for a principled reason, because I think that's an outdated system and a ridiculous system when repeatedly you have the person who gets less votes who ends up winning. So take your race baiting and your race hustling, Bill, for a fucking hike. And guess what? Certainly liberals like myself, we want the popular vote to determine the winner because that's democracy, and not for nefarious reasons, because we think our policies are better for the people. And he says, oh, that would solidify liberal wins. You're damn right, because more people are liberal, because those ideas are better. How do you like them apples? Okay. All right, now let's make fun of a Democratic senator. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin went on CNN. Now, this guy is a blue dog Democrat, which means he's openly one of the most conservative Democrats in the country. Typically, blue dogs come from Republican states, so they're Democrats within Republican states. So what they do is they run like Republicans. They're basically Republicans with the title Democrat. And you're going to see that. That comes through here. So he spoke about the issue of opioid addiction and drugs, and he gave what I think might legitimately be the dumbest quote of 2016.
What do you want President-elect Trump to do about this problem, sir?
Well, we need to declare war on drugs, on illicit drugs.
Yeah, if only somebody had did that, say, 30 or 40 years ago, maybe the problem would be solved. Come on, man. Come on. You can't be that stupid. You cannot be that stupid. The war on drugs has been an unmitigated disaster. We've been doing it. It led to the current problems. So we spent over $1 trillion in the war on drugs. What did it get us? People are using drugs just as much as they were before the war on drugs. In fact, according to
some, it's actually gotten worse. So maybe more people are using drugs, and we just flushed $1 trillion down the toilet. By the way, tens of thousands of people have died in a literal war because there is a literal drug war going on. The Mexican drug cartels, people were saying, they have now become mega cartels. So there were, like, fights between the Mexican government, Mexican authorities, and mega cartels. Turns out when you ban a substance, when you do prohibition, criminal gangs get much more powerful. That's exactly what happened with prohibition of alcohol. So we banned alcohol, and then the mafia got massively powerful because you gave them a monopoly. You gave them the entire market. So then they're the ones who are reaping all the rewards, and then whenever there are disputes and it's on the black market, you solve it with guns and murder and crime. Now, if it was legal, that wouldn't be the case. If it was legal, you go to court with suits and ties and you figure out how to resolve your issues. So notice, when we legalized alcohol, crime in relation to alcohol dropped massively. Well, it's the same thing with drugs. If you were to legalize, tax, and regulate drugs, regulate them, yes, regulate, well, what would happen? You'd have a massive decrease in crime. There's no doubt about it. But I mean, think about that. People have died, tens of thousands of people have died as a result of this war on drugs. Crime has increased as a result of this war on drugs. We wasted over $1 trillion. And we now know, based on information that's released, that what they were talking about behind the scenes when they implemented the war on drugs. Nixon admitted, he's like, yeah, we're doing this to crack down on the white hippies and the blacks and the minorities. Those are not demographics that are ever going to favor our ideas, so we got to find a way to victimize them and, you know, control them. So ban what they do. What do they do? I don't know. They do LSD. They do smoke weed. And all right, banned. Let's do this war on drugs. Ugh. Again, this is now admitted. This is now admitted. We have the quotes. These are facts. So, but this guy, drugs are bad, okay? Like Mr. Mackey from South Park. Drugs are bad, okay? And we need like a war on drugs, okay? We've been doing it. It's led to the problems that you're seeing right now. If you legalize, tax, and regulate, by the way, you know what you can do. When you regulate, that doesn't mean wild, wild west, you can get whatever you want at any time for any reason. No, if you legalize, tax, and regulate, you can actually regulate out of existence the worst versions of the different substances. So what usually when I say, hey, I want to legalize drugs, people go, oh yeah, Kyle, crystal meth, you want to legalize crystal meth? Actually, no, I don't. Because if you legalize drugs, crystal meth, you could say, hey, look, the way that that's made with the additives in there, that's the problem. Fucking people's teeth are rotting out of their mouths, and you got all these social ills that are tied to it. I get that. But if you legalize other versions of amphetamines that are more mild amphetamines that aren't cut with the disgusting shit, well, then people could get that high without having to have, you know, all the teeth problems and the blisters on their face and the issues. So, and again, there's historical precedent for this. And this is the case, think of crocodile, another one. People go, oh, really, you're going to legalize crocodile? Crocodile is like the poor man's heroin, but it, the way it's made, it makes your fucking skin rot off, literally. People start taking crocodile, they die within a year or two. So if you had legalized opioids, milder opioids, and, you know, make them available and regulate them to make sure they're safe and not cut with grotesque shit, well, then people would get their fix that way. And I'm not saying it's not a total cure-all and that nobody will ever be addicted again. Of course people will get addicted. But that's what leads to the main point here. The answer isn't war on drugs, be punitive, lock people up and throw away the key if they're doing drugs or if they're caught with drugs or if they're selling drugs. The answer is for the people who are genuinely addicted, rehab, dipshit, treat it like a medical problem. I mean, these guys are, oh my God, the opioid crisis, we have this addiction issue. Right. So treat it like the medical problem it is. But they don't. You know, yeah, no, war on drugs. People with guns, that'll solve this. That's always the answer in the U.S. More guns, more people with more guns, and then everything will be good. Except we've been doing that for decades, and it's worse. It brought us to where we are right now. Get your head out of your ass. Stop being ignorant and look at actual solutions. Okay. right, now let's go to how much time I got left? Am I running out of time here? Let me see. I got 20 minutes? Just making sure. Got to stay on top, dog. All right, I got three stories left for you. And then I'm on break till Tuesday, baby. I'll miss you. Mwah. Kisses. All right. Lena Dunham made some comments on the issue of abortion that really pissed off the internet. So I want to go through this with you here. Time Magazine explains. Dunham recalled visiting a Planned Parenthood in Texas where she was asked to share her own abortion story. So here's what Lena went on to say on her podcast. I wanted to make it really clear to her that as much as I was going out and fighting for other women's options, I myself had never had an abortion. And I realized then that even I was carrying within myself stigma around this issue. Even I, the woman who cares as much as anybody about a woman's right to choose, felt it was important that people know that I was unblemished in this department. It was an important moment for me then to realize that I had internalized some of what society was throwing at us, and I had to put it in the garbage. But then she added this. Now, I can say that I still haven't had an abortion, but I wish I had. Come on, son. Come on, son. This is... I have a lot to say about this, and I can't get any of it out. Okay, so the mentality from the left on abortion is supposed to be understanding, open-minded, tolerant. So if you had an abortion, look, it's okay. It's all right. You're not a bad person, you know. That should be our philosophy, our mentality, and that's been our philosophy and our mentality. This is a bastardization of that and a trivialization of that, because now you're taking that which should be tolerated, that's that which we should be tolerant towards, and you're pretending it's a virtue. Like what? What do you want to do? You want to have a fucking parade? You want to, like, cheerlead people who get an abortion and hold it up as some sort of totally moral and just act? It's preferable if you have an abortion versus if you don't have an abortion. No! The whole, like, the old Democratic phrase on this, which is totally true, I think, is, yes, we're Democrats. We're in favor of, we're open-minded. So we believe in abortion, and it should be legal, safe, and rare. You want to know why that was the position? Because we're sane. You're insane. You want to, like, fucking... I wish I had one, because they're so lovely and wonderful and brilliant. Who says that? Who says that? You know who says that? Somebody who's caught up their own ass. Somebody who's drunk the Kool-Aid of identity politics so much that they've just bastardized all the actual arguments in favor of liberal ideology, and they're willing to be, and here's the main point, so disconnected from regular people. Everybody listens to the show. I'm as progressive as it gets in the context of the United States. But when I hear stuff like this, I go, oh, sweet Jesus. You're handing Rick Santorum a fucking, like, a present. Here's a prize. Go ahead and mock all liberals as moronic because she's a moron. That's what you're doing. Like, we don't stop. We don't want you on our team, talking liberals and progressives. You are a goofball. And you know what I find? I found this a lot recently. There's McFeminism and there's McLiberalism. McFeminism is feminism that's about as real as the chicken and the chicken McNuggets. McLiberalism, same thing. Liberalism that's about as real as the chicken and the chicken McNuggets. These are prime examples of this, and it's gotten worse. I noticed it with Hillary's people first, and she was Team Hillary to death. So what you got from them was any actual substantive conversation about the issues. If Bernie wants to talk about, hey, let's do Medicare for all, let's do Universal College, If Bernie wants to talk about, hey, let's end the wars, let's not do all these crazy interventions. If Bernie wants to talk about taxing the rich more, taxing corporations more, he wants to go super detailed into all the specifics of what we need to do policy-wise in the country. And he attacks Hillary Clinton on those things because, hey, you're kind of sold out to Wall Street and you're too hawkish and all those things. What was the response from this crowd? Sexist. Sexist. You're sexist. You're Bernie, bro. You're sexist. You're a misogynist. And you're the one that's not really liberal, they would say to Bernie and his followers. They say, Bernie bros, Bernie bros. So you know what that is? It's a smear. They can't have a conversation on the issues and win in the realm of ideas. So they smear. They're not policy-oriented, so you smear. It's not really about making people's lives better. It's about playing the game and being on a team, and I'm on team righteous and liberal, but in reality, Mick-liberal, and yeah, so I'm going to say everything is sexist, say everything is racist, and trivialize important issues like abortion by saying, I wish I had one. Get off of our team. You're a ridiculous person. Nobody wants you on our team. You are the reason, you're one of the reasons why so many not bad people have abandoned the left. And they go, oh, yeah, the left, they're all social justice warrior idiots. You know, they're all just too sensitive and this and that. And they look at people like Lena Dunham and they go, I can't be on, all right, well, I'm going to be on her team. I'll vote for the same person as her, as Lena fucking Dunham. Bothers me because it's taking the people in the country, the leftists, who are correct on policy substance, and you are doing nothing but damage by turning them off to the point where they can't even hear that message. They can't hear the message of, hey, we're the only modern nation that doesn't have a single-payer healthcare system. Hey, have you seen the list of countries the U.S. has invaded since World War II? They can't hear the real arguments and how right we are because they can't get past your bullshit of, oh, yeah, yeah. I haven't had an abortion, but I wish I had one. Aren't I so liberal? No, you're kind of an idiot. Okay. And don't you dare try to find a deeper fucking point in this. She's not making some sort of deep fucking chess move point. This is just, she's being an idiot. Okay, I'm done. I'm off it. All right, next. That story pissed me off. I don't know if you could tell. Look, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay if you got an abortion. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with that. It is a bastardization of the issue of abortion to say, I wish I had one. Okay. There's a really bizarre story that broke yesterday that I wanted to share with you. Fox News actually broke this story. They say, the families of three victims of the Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando have filed a lawsuit against three tech giants alleging they provided material support to ISIS. The families of Tevin Crosby, Javier Jorge Reyes, and Juan Ramon Guerrero filed a complaint in the Eastern District of Michigan against Facebook, Twitter, and Google, specifically YouTube, for allegedly providing platforms that influence the radicalization of gunman Omar Mateen. So the Pulse nightclub shooting was, of course, the gay club where 49 people were slaughtered in a terrorist attack by a guy who was radicalized. And we had the 911 tapes released on this. The guy said, I'm doing this because I want you to stop bombing Syria. I'm doing this because of all the U.S. bombs being dropped in the Middle East. And he pledged allegiance to ISIS. So you got a mix of flat-out religious Islamic fundamentalism, and you have, you know, the classic blowback backlash from foreign policy thing going on too. But there's a reason why he targeted a gay club. He targeted a gay club because, you know, it's not like there was an army of gays marching into the Middle East and killing people. It's because there's the toxic religious ideology that he was brainwashed with by his father. His father had done, like, pro-Taliban videos and shit. So I have nothing but sympathy for the families of everybody who died that night. Of course, my heart breaks for them. My heart bleeds for them. I wish we could, you know, get rid of this kind of hatred and disgusting fundamentalism and anger and violence on the planet. So I really mean that. I'm on their side 100%. But this is not the way to go about it. You don't... You're suing Facebook, Twitter, and Google, specifically YouTube, for providing platforms that influence the radicalization of gunman Omar Mateen. I mean, you're just suing the internet because it has things on there that might be bad. What do you want them to do? Turn the internet into a giant padded room so that anybody who goes on it sees nothing but flowery, happy stuff? I mean, they do that in North Korea. Hey, you're only going to get the picture of the world that we want you to see. So there's no freedom. There's no dissenting ideas. And in this wide net that you're casting of, I want to stop bad people. Well, where does that line end? So, okay, first it's jihadists. Let's stop jihadists. Then maybe it's just, I don't know, you're really a really conservative Muslim. You're not a jihadist. You don't want to do violence, but you have really backwards social ideas. You know, you want women to basically be treated as second-class citizens, and they need to know their role, and gays are bad. And so do you ban that too? And then it becomes, okay, that's just, you know, Muslim fundamentalism. What about ultra-Orthodox Jews who are super conservative? What about fundamentalist Christians who believe many of the same things as the fundamentalist Muslims and the fundamentalist Jews? You know, where do you stop? Does it just become, hey, you're racist, so we're going to ban you from the internet and you can't say anything on the internet. Hey, you have opinions that don't coincide with the opinions of the government. We're going to have to get rid of you. There's no end to this. Once you go down this road, it's the slippery slope in the world. Once you open that door, you go right down it. And it's all a matter, and notice, what's offensive to one is not always what's offensive to somebody else. So if a Ted Cruz fan watches secular talk, they would want me banned. They want me banned like that, of course. So, but does that mean they should make the decisions because they were offended? Of course not. So we all agree jihadists are bad. And, you know, we should actively argue against their points of view. We should lay out exactly why that is, and we should destroy them in the marketplace of ideas. But for you to sue Facebook, Twitter, and Google as if they are personally responsible for all of the stuff that's put on their platform, I simply don't agree with that. You know, as far as I'm concerned, those platforms should be as open as humanly possible. And the only time you can and should take legal action against them is if there's like a direct threat of violence. And I'm going to kill Todd at fucking 5:30 on Thursday at this place. And, you know, so if the medium's used for that, obviously you arrest the person who committed the crime, but then maybe you have a conversation with Facebook or Google or whoever, and you say, look, man, you got to set up a process by which, you know, we can avoid things like this. Something like that I get. But when you start saying it's just the ideology and this and that, look, the opposite can happen too, and they don't even acknowledge that. That somebody like myself, I could see the barbarism and savagery of ISIS, and I go, oh, that's nice. I would never want to be anywhere affiliated with those people in any way, shape, or form, and they're monsters, they're modern-day fucking Nazis. And honestly, I think most people have that response. If you see a brutal ISIS video, the overwhelming majority of people go, oh, they're fucking crazy, and they don't want to have anything to do with them. So just because Omar Mateen saw that and he was attracted to it doesn't mean that the thing is inherently appealing to people and doesn't mean that you should sue the platform that they operated on. And again, I think it actually might be good for intelligence purposes for Twitter and other people to allow these clowns. Because what are you going to find out? I don't know. You have some people who are in the government who speak Arabic who can, okay, look, ISIS is planning a plot in this place, and they were just tweeting about it. Who knows? Who knows? So I don't, this is crazy. You don't get to sue these platforms because some people who use those platforms used it to nefarious ends. Do they get credit? So if somebody watched a YouTube video and then they win the lottery, does YouTube get to say, oh, well, you know, you watched a video about buying a lottery ticket, you bought a lottery ticket and you won, now I'm entitled to a percentage of those winnings? No, everybody says that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Right? Well, how is that any different from this? But their argument is, hey, because of YouTube, this person got bad ideas. Because of Twitter, this person got bad ideas and they did bad things. So we are going to, it's on you that those things happened. Well, by the same token, oh, this person got the idea to buy a lotto ticket. A good thing happened because they got the good idea from these mediums. So it is on you that the good thing happened. So now you take your cut of the lottery winnings. No, it's just, it's crazy. It's fucking crazy. So I have nothing but sympathy for these people. But what happened is you got tricked by, you know, insane lawyers into a frivolous lawsuit, and they're trying to get paid, and they're using you. That's what happened. Okay. And finally, last story of the week, and we are back on Tuesday. So no show Thursday, Friday, and Monday. A police officer in Georgia named Sylvia Kotris was fired from her job because she was flying a Confederate flag at her house. Now, she claims that the flag was being flown by her roommate, not by her. I have no idea if that's true or not. I got to be honest, my gut reaction is no. It sounds like a dodge. But she also went on to say this, quote, "If I knew it offended someone, my friends, my family, I wouldn't do it." Okay, so on that point, really, you didn't know that the Confederate flag is offensive to some people? You didn't know that? And she says, "My friends, my family." So, wait, if it's offensive to anybody, you wouldn't put it up? Or if it's just offensive to your friends and your family, you wouldn't do it? Okay, again, these are side points. This is neither here nor there. But now what's happening is she either wants her job back, she's suing to get her job back, or to get 10 years of pay and benefits. So that's the question that's on the table right now. Is it fair game for a police officer to be fired from their job because they flew a Confederate flag? Now, on the one hand, look, you got to call it what it is. You're flying a Confederate flag. It's a symbol of the Confederacy. It's a symbol of slavery. In fact, the modern-day Confederate flag that we see was actually brought back and resurrected specifically as a fuck you to the civil rights movement and as a sign of being pro-segregation. That wasn't the original Confederate flag. The original Confederate flag back when they were fighting for slavery looked a little bit different. But that newer one was resurrected during the civil rights movement to say, fuck you, we support segregation. So all this idea, oh, you know, Southern pride and heritage and you're tap dancing around the actual meaning of it. And maybe it came to mean Southern pride to you, but the core thing behind it is, and we all know it, racism. It's bigotry. It is what it is. So, I mean, if you deny that the Confederate flag is a symbol of bigotry, that's ridiculous. I don't know what to say to you. So that's what it means. And if you're somebody who's a police officer, that means you're responsible not only for policing the white people in your community, but you also have to, you know, protect and serve the black community. You also have to protect and serve minorities. You flying that flag is a sign, I have a massive bias. I have a massive bias for the white people against the black people, and I'm probably not going to be all that fair to the black people. I'm letting you know. I'm literally flying the flag on that point. So when I think about it from that perspective, I go, you don't have a right to a job as a police officer. There's no right to be a police officer. If you express, so where would it end? What if she said, yeah, I was on my property and I screamed the N-word repeatedly. And I screamed it and I was talking about how dirty N-words are the worst people on the planet. Can she then turn around and go, freedom of speech? Freedom of speech, I don't know what you mean. You can't take away my job. So what, I'm massively racist, but you can't take away my job. But this is a specific area where your decision-making affects African-Americans. You are the law. If you're a fucking cashier or some shit, you know, or you have a different – you're a garbage man or something, like, so you're racist. I don't want you to be racist, but taking away your job might be way too punitive because, what, I'm going to police you and – say, oh, that's a thought crime, so you can't have that job. But when it's a police officer, that's a specific job where black lives are in your hands sometimes, and you don't care about them. So when I look at it from that perspective, that's my reaction. But then the other argument is, okay, it was on her private time, on her private property, and all she's doing is expressing unpopular opinions. Once you open the door to firing people for unpopular opinions when it's on their private time, on their own property, that is a terrible precedent in terms of big government. Where does that end? So to flip the script, I don't know, imagine there's some police officer who flies like the communist flag or something, you know, not in solidarity with the Soviet Union, but the communist flag, like, yeah, that's my ideology. I'm Marxist. I believe in communism. Should the right-wingers be able to say, fire him, because he's got a flag up and I disagree with the flag? Again, I don't know. And also, there is the angle of, if you're a police officer, that's the government. So that would be the government punishing you because of your speech. If you have a flag up, like, that's free expression, that's free speech. So it's the government saying, I'm going to take something away from you, I'm going to punish you because of your speech. That is a borderline, you know, borderline not allowing free speech. I mean, it is. Again, I guess the counter argument to that is, but you don't have a right to be a police officer. Like, that's a job. They're not locking you up for flying the Confederate flag. That would be the real violation of free speech. But to say you can't have this job anymore, that's different because it's a job. You don't have a right to that job. They could fire you for whatever reason. So I don't know. I think I lean towards getting it, why they would fire her, because you can't have somebody who's racist and openly racist whose job is in part to look after the black community and do right by them. I mean, how would you feel if you're a black person in the community and you know this police officer loves the Confederacy? But then again, so she argues, well, I didn't put it up. So at least that's an attempt for her to say, I'm not like that. I don't believe that. Again, so it gets murky, man. I don't know. Part of me, the fucking uber free speech absolutist, is like, that's a bad precedent. You fire somebody for a flag or you fire somebody for speech in their off time on their own property. Where does that end? It doesn't just end with police officers. I mean, if this was a private business, and somebody was fired because of something they said on their off time or a flag they flew on their off time, I would defend them because that's none of the businesses or the job's business. Excuse me. It's none of the job's business what you're saying or doing on your off time and your thought policing. I don't know. As you can tell, I'm really torn on this, and I'm really curious what everybody thinks. The free speech absolutist in me says you got to let her go because it's a terrible precedent to set. And even though she might not be a good person, this isn't grounds to fire. But then the other part of me says, I can't imagine being a black person in a community she's supposed to serve, knowing that she's basically openly racist, which is what I think the evidence points to, even though she's denying that she flew it. So I don't know. You guys tell me what you think. This is a rare Secular Talk instance where I'm exactly 50-50. All right, guys. I love you, and we will see you on Tuesday. Everybody enjoy time off if you have it. Enjoy Christmas. Enjoy the holidays. Mwah. I'm out. Peace.